Hi, everyone. I'm Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Kelsey. That was brilliant, and I strongly identify. Absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's see. I have been sober 8 days, 11 months, and 27 years. And there's been a lot of experience in between all of that. And I'm grateful to be here. I was really grateful. Thank you, Nikki. I don't know if she made it. I know she said she was running late. I thought I was going to be the latest. I, too, took a wrong turn. I ended up at 101 North Florida and realized that wasn't it. But thankfully, it was only about 15 more minutes, and I got here just in the nick of time. But thank you, Nikki, for inviting me to come up here and speak. You know, so coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not something that I wanted to do. It wasn't on my radar at all. I drank, and I drank really well. I believe I would have drank any one of you under the table because that's the way I drank, and I loved drinking. I didn't do a lot of things well, but I could drink well. I drank really, really good, and I could drink a lot. The only thing that ever used to, like, really take me out was wine. And I used to try. I would try to sit back and drink a glass of wine. I'd wind up drinking the bottle, and I inevitably, every time, I blacked out. So wine was not my thing, but I kept trying. And, you know, when I drank like a drunk, I didn't know that's the way I was drinking. I drank to get drunk, because what's the point? Why would you have just a couple? Why would you just have one? So every time I picked up a drink, my intention was to get drunk. And before I started drinking, I want to just make note of this. The unmanageability of my soul existed long before I ever picked up a drink. And here's how I know, and this is all hindsight. Of the many stories, I want to tell you this one. I used to go, we lived in this apartment complex, and I was in about, I don't know, it was like maybe fourth or fifth grade, just old enough to start to take an interest in boys. I love so-and-so written all over my book cover, you know. And there was this boy, Tony, we'll call him Tony, because that was his name. And he lived at this end of the same building, and I lived at this end. And there were a bunch of other school friends that lived in this apartment complex, and I would go outside, and I would walk around the tennis courts waiting for somebody to come and play with me. And when they didn't, I would go inside, and I would feel sorry for myself, because it didn't ever occur to me to go knock on somebody's door to see if somebody wanted to play, right? I mean, I just seem to have been born with my eyeballs turned inward. It's just the way that it is, and anyway, we had a snow day. This is up in New Jersey. We had a snow day. School was closed. So I went outside and I did my walk around the tennis courts, and nobody came out to play with me. And I decided that I was going to put on this dramatic snowstorm show and walk past Tony's window, because I love Tony. And I want him to come out and, like, play along and rescue me. And so I come up. And I go past his window, and I'm putting on a big show. I'm, like, going through the snow, and I'm falling down, and I'm getting up, and it's all right in front of him. He's got double windows and a couple other windows. And I do this whole thing, and then I get up, and I walk down to my apartment, and I stop, and I turn around, and I look, and I wait. And Tony never comes outside. He never came outside. So I went inside. Now, I went from this great idea, exciting, elevated state of emotion to, I should just die. As a matter of fact, I'm going to kill myself. So I go inside the kitchen and I decide I'm going to end it. I'm going to kill myself. So I start going through Mom's cabinets. What's in the cabinet? What can I take? And she has these little ink vials that are these color vials that are in the cabinet in the kitchen, and I'm gonna suck them down, and I'm gonna give myself ink poisoning, and I'm just gonna kill myself and end it all. So I go over to the sink and I take out one of the bottles, and I suck all the color out of this little bottle. It tastes terrible, and then I realize it's food coloring. So I throw it in the trash, rinse out my mouth, and I carry on. I carry on with my day as if that never happened. Now that's interesting in hindsight because I was resolved in that moment to die. Elevated state of emotion, bottomless pit state of emotion. Now, as I got older, I started to recognize that state of mind was like this all day, every day. So when I was 12 years old, now that's only a few years later, I discovered Grandma's whiskey in her cabinet. And I was riding home on a school bus. My mom, she liked to move around a lot, and so we were now living in Lakewood and with my grandmother. And my grandmother had sold this beautiful house. She had divorced my grandfather and moved into this little, like, one-bedroom apartment over top of the Lakewood drugstore. And she kept her china closet, her china cabinet, fully stocked underneath with all kinds of booze from her bar, and then, you know, wine glasses, those china and whatever. And then she had this other smaller little cabinet that had those little gold juice glasses. Remember Grandma's little 6-ounce juice glasses? So I'm riding the bus home, and so, I don't remember her name, but she became my new best friend on the ride home from school. And she came home with me, and I said to her, I suggested, let's try Grandma's whiskey. And I used to say, I didn't know how I knew this, and then I rewatched The Karate Kid. And you know, Mr. Miyagi, when he gets drunk and he's fallen down, and the guy and Daniel-san, he picks up the whiskey and he smells it and he doesn't drink it. I knew from watching that movie, don't smell the whiskey because you won't drink it, and I wanted to drink it. And I didn't really know why I wanted to drink it, but I wanted to drink it. I mean, there was something to it. I always noticed alcohol. When my parents ever had a party, I noticed them pouring special stuff into the punch, and I wasn't allowed to drink it, and I never could get my hands on it. It was very frustrating. And, you know, and Dad would drink beer all the time, poolside, you know, so I always noticed alcohol, and I just knew I wanted to get my hands on this whiskey. So I take out those little juice glasses. I probably poured about maybe 3 ounces because the glass was about half full. And in each glass, and I told the girl, my best friend, I said, don't smell that. And what do you think she did? She didn't want to drink it as bad as I did, I'm certain. So I just was like, whatever. So I took mine, I didn't smell it, and I slammed it down fast. It hurt. But within, it felt like seconds, but I learned factually it takes about 7 to 8 minutes to actually get that warm effect produced. But man, it felt immediate. And that's exactly what happened. It was like all of a sudden, I never knew that I was restless, irritable, and discontent until I had that first drink. Because everything, I was like, that's nice. And then I looked at her, and she's just watching me, and I said, are you going to drink that? And she said, no. So I took hers, and I slammed it. But this time, it went down really smooth. There was no pain. There was nothing, right? So I'm 12 years old. I'm about 100-plus pounds, and I've just slammed about 4 to 6 ounces of whiskey. And I said, let's go downstairs across the street. There was this little fast food chicken place, like a Chick-fil-A type of place. I said, let's go over there. And she's agreeing with me. She was my best friend. She's like my puppy, right? We went everywhere that day. So we go downstairs and we go into this chicken place, and I proceeded to act like a 12-year-old drunk. I mean, use your imagination. They called the police. The police came, and I'm like, they said they called the police. So I thought, well, I should probably leave then. And I remember thinking I should probably leave. And as I walked out the door, the police pulled up. They had me do, like, they asked me some questions. I want to say they asked me to tell the alphabet, but I don't actually really remember. I think that just sounds cool. They asked me to say the alphabet, and I couldn't. Anyway, they put me in the back seat of the police car. They brought me down to the police station, and then they locked me in this little, like, 100-square-foot room. And now here's an interesting thing, and this is hindsight. Because remember, there was this unmanageability that existed in my soul that I was not aware of. Restless, irritable, discontent. So when they walked me to lock me in this little room, as I'm walking past it, I'm noticing this big glass window, and the thought crosses my mind, ooh, I wonder if that's bulletproof glass. It was very exciting all of a sudden. And they walk me down, and then they have me go sit, and there's a bench and a vent, this big glass window, and they shut this big, heavy, really it slammed. They slammed this big, heavy metal door behind me and locked it. And they locked me in this little thing. But here's the interesting thing. I remember feeling really safe that I was locked in a bulletproof 100-square-foot room. I wasn't scared. I wasn't afraid. Any consequence, it was completely inconsequential because I was having an effect produced by alcohol. I didn't know that. I didn't have this language then, but that's exactly what was happening. Restless, irritable, discontent, fear, remorse, guilt, shame, none of that stuff existed. And I didn't have a lot of, like, I mean, at 12 years old, I wasn't running amok so much, but that spiritual malady and that unmanageability existed, like I said, long before I ever picked up the drink. So when I had the effect produced by alcohol and I was locked in a little room, that was my jam. That was awesome. So I sang 99 bottles of beer on the wall till my mama came and picked me up. She did. They basically slapped me on the wrist and they said, you know better than that. And I said, yes, officer, I do. And don't do that again. Okay, I won't. And then we went home and it was on. I had had my first original extemporaneous effect produced by alcohol, and I was going to have it at all costs. So I put on my, people like us, alcoholics like us, were very clever. So I put my clever abilities to work, and I realized that everywhere I went, I could probably drink. If I had a drink, like, it would be that much better. And we used to go to the skating rink on Friday nights. And at the skating rink, I always felt like, I always had this experience, like I just didn't fit in, I didn't belong. I was always nervous. And I always felt like when I show up, they don't really want me to be here. When I would sit at the table with my friends, I'm like, they're just waiting for me to leave. And what I couldn't see was my friend Lisa would call me every Thursday night. Jen, are you going to the skating rink tomorrow night? Yeah. What are you wearing? Yeah. You know, it's like girl conversation, right? I couldn't see any of that stuff. And then I would get to the skating rink, and if I showed up after everybody, they were saving me a seat. And we used to drink cops. No, not cops. No, that was when I was trying to sober up later. Graveyards, where you would just take all the sodas and you'd fill up your cup, right? And so they would get me a graveyard, they'd save me a seat. That's what was really going on, but I didn't see any of that stuff. Remember, my eyeballs just like turned inward. So I'm going to fast forward here in a sec. I get this clever idea that if I could get some alcohol in my system when I go to the skating rink, I'm going to have a really good time. But so I went through this whole process. Can't get drunk before I go, parents will know, because they're dropping me off. How can I get booze in there? So I get this great idea, because I used to keep nail polish, colored nail polish in my purse, and then the clear, you know, for the nylons that I wasn't allowed to wear. And I thought, well, I could put nail polish remover bottles in my purse, but I could swap it out and put booze in it and get in, right? Well, now, I didn't know about non-acetone nail polish remover, so I had acetone. Anyway, I spent The whole week, 7 days, twice a day, vigorously hot soapy water washing out that acetone nail polish remover bottle. Now, I did two. I did rinse out and wash two of them just in case I could maybe bring two. But it was too suspicious. So anyway, it gets to Friday night. I've filled it up with grandma's whiskey. And I got it in my purse and I get to the skating rink. Now, you know that moment when you've just gotten over on everybody, right? And I'm winning at life? Here we go. So I get up to the skating rink, and I've got my acetone bottle that's filled with whiskey in there with my nail polish, because they check your bags. That's the important part. They check your bags. So I go up there. They look in, and they take that little wand, and they look all around, and I watch them see the nail polish remover bottle. What a thrill that was, right? He closes it up. He says, have a good time. Yes. And I'm winning at life. I am winning. So I get inside. I make a mad dash to the bathroom because I'm going to go get lit up now because I'm having a good time. I'm going to feel good like I did with that first drink. I get into the bathroom. I get about half of the bottle down, and I can't seem to get past, it's burning like it did the first time, but I can't get past the acetone smell. And I'm trying, and I'm going like this, and I'm trying to push it and keep it down, and I can't. So the whiskey smell and the acetone smell, it all comes right back up. Right, that was me. And I'm like, oh my God. Now, despair is settling in. Heightened state of emotion, I just beat life. And despair has just shown up on my front door in a matter of minutes. So, I was like, okay. I clean myself up and I renew my resolve. And I've got half a bottle left. And I try, and I can't even get a drop down because I can't get past the acetone smell. The hot soapy water does not rinse out acetone smell, by the way, if you ever try this. So anyway, I have no alcohol to get into my system, none. And I had the despair and the hopelessness of that moment of having solved all my problems to go out there and have a good time, just got flushed down the toilet. And I had no opportunity to get it back in me. So I actually cried. And then I cleaned myself up, I straightened up, and then I had this really great idea, and this is interesting to me, this is all hindsight. Maybe I could just act like I'm tipsy. And I did, and you want to know what? It was a smashing success because, now this is what I didn't know, but I understand it now. It solicited just enough attention to get me by, to make me feel like I fit in, because people were like, she tipsy, but I had this power going for myself, I'll never tell. So then that was the start. That was my first experience. That was my second experience. But that unmanageability in my soul existed long before I ever picked up that drink, and it was present when I started drinking, thank you, and all throughout my drinking. And every time I picked up a drink, what I didn't understand was I was always seeking that original effect produced by alcohol. I was that 10th drink, that thousandth time party. It was always in my mind that I was going to have that original extemporaneous effect produced by alcohol. But what I couldn't understand is that every time I would emerge from a drunk, every time my soul that was already unmanageable emerged worse. I was getting worse every time I was getting drunk, and I was drinking every time to try to solve that. And it just kept going ad infinitum. It just kept going and going and going until I had hit a bottom, and it wasn't pretty. I was shacking up with this guy. I was underage. I was an underage drinker. And I got a job in a bar because I had flashed them a fake ID one time to go in there and drink, and then I wanted a job, so they just assumed because I drank in that bar that I was of age, and so they gave me, like, I was like the pool table girl, like the cocktail girl, and I would have to clean the pool tables, and people would tip me in drinks, which it was brilliant. It was like the best job ever until I wanted money. But anyway, I met this guy, and I was... And I shacked up with him, and, you know, that was just not a good experience. I did really incomprehensible and demoralized things with this man, all in an attempt to solve, you know, to satisfy, like, this need to feel safe, to feel needed, to feel wanted. The drinking, you know, I was desperate to drink to resolve that restless, irritable, and discontent and that unmanageability that I wasn't aware really existed. And I remember waking up one morning. Well, I have an uncle who, I have an uncle who had come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was only interested in the counseling. So I called him about the counselor. And the counselor sent me to AA. And I rocked up into my first AA meeting. Now, I was shacking up with this guy, and this girl I was hanging out with was icky, we'll just say that. And I didn't think she was icky because she had lots of stuff going for her, you know what I mean? And I was interested in all of that stuff. And anyway, I was hanging out with this guy that I'm shacking up with, and I said something, and he said something about her that was really derogatory. And I remember saying to him, gosh, if that's what you think about her, what do you think about me? And you know what he said? There's a mirror in the bathroom. I know, dog. What a dog, right? But I felt like a slug that just got, like, salt poured on him, right? I was a vision for you in many ways when I came into AA. And, well, so I rock up to my first AA meeting, and I was ready. And I tried to take over the meeting. And people were in a circle, and they started sharing, and I would try to, thank you, I would try to solve all their problems. And I did that with the first person who shared, and nobody said anything. So I tried it with the second person that shared, and the chairperson said, we just share one at a time here, and we're happy to answer your questions after this meeting. Well, I was highly insulted, but I sat there because I was too embarrassed to get up and leave. So I sat there, and that was my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and they did, in fact, do that. People rallied around me. And these are the things I think about in hindsight. Alcoholics Anonymous rallied around me, and you know, they invited me to coffee. I joined not the Friday night group, I joined the Sunday night group. And Friday nights at 10, we would go to fellowship. We would all meet about an hour before the meeting. And then after the meeting, we would go to this little diner in Newport Richey called Nip's Diner. It's now a real estate place, but anyway, it was Nip's Diner, and we would go there, and they were open till like 2 in the morning, and we would get there at like 11:30 at night, and we would stay there till 2 in the morning, and all the AAers would just rally around, and we would eat muffins and salads and bread, and tons of coffee, and they would just talk AA, and people were laughing and cutting up, and I found the fellowship incredibly attractive. I felt safe in that environment. I didn't know what was going on. A lot of times my share would be like, what do you guys want from me? I don't have any experience, strength, and hope. And they would just laugh, and they would say, keep coming back, Jennifer. Thank you. And I'm really glad that I did. So those were my first experiences with AA. And I didn't know what was going on. And like I started out saying here tonight, I did not know that I was alcoholic or what that really meant. And the things I've shared with you, I've learned over time. And what happened about 50, 60 days or so, I had some tickets to a concert, and I really wanted to go to this concert. And I didn't get drunk at the concert, but I held on to the tickets. And I was doing everything that I was doing except not drinking. I was still hanging out in the bar. I was still shooting pool. I was still throwing darts. I didn't work at that place. They hadn't banned me from there yet because they didn't know that I was underage just yet. But I was still living, you know, I was staying up till 3 a.m. I was knocking on boys' windows, trying to get in, you know, stealing cartons of cigarettes from the store, you know, and trying to be sober. But I didn't have a clue. And anyway, I wound up, some friends were coming over, and they were bringing booze, and I knew it. And I remember running out my door when they pulled up, and I paused for a second, and I looked over my shoulder, and I said, "Sorry, God." And I ran out the door, and I got lit up like a Christmas tree. And I did all kinds of heinous things, things I'm not going to talk about here, because they ended up on my fourth step and in my fifth step where they belong. However, you need to know, it wasn't pretty, and it's taken a long time to get over the kind of shame that comes with living like that. So, the next day, I woke up with this guy next to me. Now, by this time, I had a baby, and he's about 11 months old at the time. He's 28 now. He was about 11 months old. And I'm proud of him. That's why I said that. I showed up, I dropped this guy off, I come home, and I'm just writhing with the horror and the remorse of the night before. And I call the AA hotline, and the AA member on the other end answers the phone. And I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I drank last night. I said, I'm an alcoholic, I go to AA, and I drank last night. And she said, "So what?" So I thought she didn't hear me, so I said it louder. I said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I go to AA, and I drank last night." And she said quickly, "So?" So then I thought she didn't understand it, so I explained it. And I said, "I'm an alcoholic. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous to not drink. You're not supposed to drink there, and I drank last night." And she did this thing. She paused, which made me pause. And then she said, "Jennifer, do you want to drink anymore?" And so I just reflected back to her what she did, and I paused. But in that pause, I did something I never did. I asked myself, I said, "Jennifer, do you want to drink anymore?" And it bubbled up from the depth of my belly, "No." So I said, "No." She said, "All right." This was a Wednesday night. She said, this was a Wednesday, no, morning. She said to me, "Go to the meeting tonight. It's located here. They're having a business meeting. Make it your home group. Get a service position and don't leave there without a sponsor." And then she hung up the phone. She did not care. She did not care what my story was. If you're an alcoholic and you think you have a drinking problem, Alcoholics Anonymous can help. If you don't want to drink anymore. So I went to that meeting. We're holding hands at the end of the circle. Buffy's in my right hand, and I didn't let her hand go, and she leaned over and she said, "Can I help you?" I said, "I need a sponsor. Do you do that?" Now, my ideas of sponsorship were NASCAR drivers, and those first 60 days I didn't need a sponsor because I'm not a NASCAR driver. But now, I don't want to drink, and Buffy's in my right hand. She became my sponsor. I don't think she really found out what the depths of alcoholism are and that it's a fatal malady. And maybe she did, I don't know. She taught me progress, not perfection, and she taught me about carrying AA's prayers in my pocket to take them out in the midst of the day when I'm emotional, when I have any emotional upheavals, or even when I don't, and to make it a regular habit. And then she disappeared, and I found out several years ago that she committed suicide. And I don't know what her story was after that or up until that point. But what I've learned about myself now, this is a fatal malady that I have, this unmanageability that exists within me, the spiritual malady that manifests itself in self-will run riot, though I usually don't think so, and I want to call it all these other things. I want to make it all these other outside things that it's not. It's that. I have a spiritual malady, thank you, that is solved. I have a spiritual malady that, left unattended, it's unmanageable. In other words, my thoughts and my emotions and my feelings and everything I'm doing, it just runs wild. I come up with these crazy stories that I tell myself. I see things that are going on that aren't really going on. And I get myself in a lot of jackpots, and I don't understand why my life is blowing up. And Alcoholics Anonymous has solved all of that. And so so when I started that journey with Buffy and I got that home group, they made me the greeter. I just remember my knees knocking every time people came up into the meeting. But my job was to get them a seat, get them a coffee. If I didn't recognize them, welcome them, you know, and greet. And so I just rocked up and I did that. And this one woman showed up one night and shared. Now, she had showed up, I didn't recognize her, so I got her coffee, helped her get a seat, and she shared that she was visiting from out of town. She had been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but things were really untenable in her own personal life, and she was having a hard time pulling it together, and she was suicidal earlier that day. And then she said this, "But then I came to this meeting, and this woman greeted me and made me feel like I'm at home. She helped me get a cup of coffee and showed me a seat. And I don't want to die anymore." And I'm paraphrasing. This is what I heard. And she's like, "I don't want to die anymore. And I'm going to give AA another shot. Thanks for being here." And I was like, what? Because I had no idea that I had any influence or anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night that I realized that I had a seat here. And, you know, and then it would go on, you know, to I would go on to understand what it means to be alcoholic and what the disease of alcoholism actually is. What I understand today is that that disease was arrested when I put the alcohol down. Dr. Jelinek, I learned in history, you know, he drew out this whole chart. He was really brilliant, but he described the disease of alcoholism as it pertains to alcohol and how we have this descent and we hit this bottom, this effect produced we're trying to get. And then if we put the drink down, you know, we come back up. But what I recognized is if you turn that paper upside down, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Drinking's only the tip of the iceberg. And the other 90% approximately, because really, like, factually, you can only see about 10% of an iceberg. The other 90% is below the surface, below where I can't see. And to me, I was like, that's alcoholism. Because I can see alcohol and all of the consequences that are coming with that, they're completely inconsequential to me because I want to keep drinking. And what is going on that I can't see, that unmanageability, that untenable experience that I have in my mind and in my body over and over and over that I keep blowing up my life. What is that? And Alcoholics Anonymous solves that. That has been my experience, and I am so grateful to be here. I'm really glad I had the opportunity to come share a little smidge of my story. We all know there's so much more, and you know what? The best is yet to come. The best is yet to come, and it only gets better from here. And the last thing I want to say, I saw this phrase. It says, take the risk or lose the chance. So if you're new here or you're older, I want to encourage you, take the risk to let it all go. Give yourself to Alcoholics Anonymous. Give it 90 days, 100% all in. Otherwise, lose the chance. Don't lose the chance. This is your chance. This is my chance, and I'm grateful for it. Thanks for giving it to me.
Thank you, Jennifer. That was great. All right. And let's see. At this time, we're going to be passing the baskets in accordance with our seventh tradition. If you'd like to contribute electronically, please let our treasurer know, who is standing up right now with his hand raised. And then Josh is going to come up and pass the chips out. Josh Alcoholic. We have a chip system to denote different lengths of sobriety. And the first one is the 24-hour, one-day chip. Would anyone like one? Nope. Okay. 1 month. 2 months. Please. 2 months? 3 months? And 6 months? Nine months? Years? And multiples. Yeah! I was the only one super excited for a second there. Anything else? 24 hours? All right, thanks.
Awesome. And we've asked a friend to come up and read Dr. Bob's last message.